Hello, hello everyone. Welcome to another episode of the TDF Writers Room. And I'm very happy today to be joined by Dr. Greg Mills, who has recently been on a trip to Ukraine, or is currently in Ukraine. Greg, very good to have you with us today. You've written recently for the Daily Friend about your travels there. Can you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're writing about?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I'm a custodian of the Platform for African Democrats. I also have a visiting position at the Royal United Services Institute and spend a lot of my time as an advisor to various heads of government across Africa. But I'm in Kiev at the moment, although I've been all over Ukraine, to write a new book. Which is provisionally entitled War of the Machines, and to spend time both speaking to military people, but also particularly technology people and those in government and those in the private sector about the war. This is the 18th visit I've made to Ukraine. I made several before the war, about 25 years ago, as part of a NATO-funded mission on training. And now, since the war in 2022, I've brought various African delegations to Ukraine to see the war for what it is from the Ukrainian side, at least, to try and help educate people about the Ukrainian perspective. And the war, of course, has changed dramatically. It's changed Ukraine dramatically, but it's also changed in terms of its various phases. And if I could best describe it, I'd say that when I first got here back in February 2022, the war was really about survival. It was about that moment where Zelensky, maybe apocryphally, said, "I don't need a ride," which he was offered out of Kiev as the Russians tried their shock and awe tactic. "I need more ammo." And it was in direct contrast to what had happened in Afghanistan in August when President Ashraf Ghani had taken a helicopter and fled and ultimately ended up in the UAE. Zelensky fought it out. There wasn't really a plan at that stage beyond survival, so they had to stop the Russian shock and awe tactics to decapitate the leadership in Kiev and stop them in the Donbass and stop the fall of potentially of Kharkiv. They were too late to stop Kherson being captured in the south, but they were able to prevent Odessa being captured and push then slowly push the Russians back. And that era or that phase of the war was described best as a mosquito strategy, sort of hit and miss, hit and run type raids conducted by the Ukrainians. And they started to use the Bayraktar drones then, the Turkish manufactured drones, along with reconnaissance copter drones, as they're called here. And then you came to the second phase of the war, which was the phase of counter-offensives, which started in September 2022, led by General Sersky in the north east around Kharkiv, and that relieved pressure on Sumy and Kharkiv as well, the second largest city in Ukraine. And that, of course, then mutated with a lot of international assistance into the great counter-offensives of June 2023, which really delivered very little. And then the war settled into a phase, the third phase of attrition. Where you have these more or less static lines. I mean, the Russians have gained about 1% of territory of Ukraine in the last 4.5 years at the expense of about 1.5 million people, of which about a third are estimated to have been killed. So it's reached proportions now which are starting to make an impact on Russian resources, even despite the fact that the population's four times larger than Ukraine's, and their economy about 10 times larger. So they too are feeling the pain because of the attritional nature of this conflict. And this phase, of course, is characterized by those things I mentioned in the early first phase, which is drones. Except the drones are no longer the standoff Bayraktar type. They're the first of all started off as FPV, first person view drones, basically racing drones. There's a genre of drones called racing drones. I've learned all the time about this. And they were used to essentially use as kamikaze copters. But at the beginning of the war, one drone would be used to maybe knock out a tank or an armored personnel carrier carrying 12, 15 people. Now they use more than one drone per person. So it's an asymmetrical conflict, drones, machines versus people. And that's led right. this attritional war, this very static war where you have a kill zone of about 10 kilometers around the contact line, fairly dynamic, people placed all over the place. But really nothing survives in that zone. Anything moves and it gets a drone on its head. And then you have a so-called gray zone, which is about 20 kilometers from the contact line, so 40 kilometers overall, where no vehicle really moves. I mean, unmanned vehicles move. Vehicles will move in to evacuate wounded people or try to do that. But that's why you've seen UGVs, unmanned ground vehicles, start to be a new phase in the drone war, as well as unmanned surface and underwater vehicles. And of course, the Ukrainians, essentially not possessing a navy, have more or less destroyed the Black Sea fleet of the Russians through their unmanned surface vehicles, particularly Sea Babies, as they're called, which have carried out all these audacious strikes on the navy and on the so-called shadow fleet. So this third phase of the war is this attritional phase, and now you're mutating into a fourth phase, which is really the phase of what Zelensky, President Zelensky, calls long-range sanctions, which are the development of long-range kamikaze drones. So these are not copters. These are fixed-wing drones, and they go anything from 200 kilometers all the way to 2,000 kilometers and even further in some instances. Some of the propeller-driven drones can go as far as 3,500 kilometers. But, of course, there's a trade-off always in warhead and range. But that's changed the nature of the war because there's more pressure at home. It's a strategic weapon. There's more pressure at home on the Russians. There's pressure when they hit Wild Breeze, the Russian equivalent of Amazon. And, of course, we've seen the rioting at fuel depots. So the war is it's not one thing. At the beginning, it was something, and now it's moved through several phases. Diplomacy is always battling to keep up through these different phases. You expect wars always end. They always start because of political failure, and they always end with a political deal. It's very unusual to have a war end by complete victory, a so-called debellation, as it's known in the terminology of strategic studies, which is what happened in the case of Nazi Germany, for instance, at the end, in the middle of 1945, complete collapse, a complete overthrow, complete defeat. But that's not going to happen here. So diplomacy has to play its part. And the book that I'm writing, it says, entitled War of the Machines, but really it's much more than that. It's a war fought with machines, but it's a war fought by people. And it's understanding the role of people in this development process through these four phases, which is really what I'm about. So I've spent time in the East. It's close enough as I dare to that gray zone. I've tried to understand the counter-drone world, tried to understand the long-range drone world, tried to understand how you control this, the software, the people behind it. And this is a society, Ukraine, which has just exploded with nationalism after 2022. Ukrainians have steadily asserted themselves, but Putin has made a grave strategic error because it's impossible to put this nationalistic sentiment back in the bottle once more. And that's what essentially he achieved that really in 2014 when he seized Crimea and the parts of the Donbass, but he cemented it in 2022. So that's what I'm here for, and I'm here for about 6 weeks to research that and write that and learn. Even this old dog learns one or two new tricks in the process.
So, I really like that idea of the four sort of phases of the war, and each of them can almost be categorized as by an image of a particular technology. So, I think about those first few weeks of the war, and a lot of the discussion online about the conflict was about things like javelins and sort of you had these Ukrainian teams moving and striking Russian positions, and there were all those Russian armored vehicles burned out on the roads in places like Bucha north of Kyiv. But then you kind of moved to this artillery phase where all the discussion was about tanks and artillery. And as you say, that kind of, I think, ended with the great counteroffensive failure in 2023. And then, of course, the drones and now the long-range drones. So there's sort of almost like a very particular technological image that goes with each. And I think that's really also, you know, you were talking to me before the show about just the speed at which everything has changed. And I think that's what, when you look at the map, it misleads you. You think, well, there's been no territorial change, but there's just so much change and counterplay between the two sides going on that the war is far more dynamic than the lines on the page, I think, suggest. I know there's been some talk that the cycles of innovation are something like a few weeks, where each side develops a new technology and then the other side develops a countermeasure. And that this is a pace of innovation that many Western armies actually would struggle to catch up and deal with.
Well, as you probably know, Nicholas, I did four assignments, deployments as the strategic advisor to the commander of ISAF in Afghanistan. So mea culpa for everything I did wrong. But we certainly tried to make an impact in a positive way on that society. And so I've got a sense of what it means to fail. And the big difference between Afghanistan and Ukraine is the sense of agency. The Ukrainians really own this. They own their struggle, and they have owned their struggle for a very long time, for centuries. And yes, it manifested itself in immediately after the First World War, and then again during the Second World War in quite nasty ways. And then it really, of course, took off in 1991 with the declaration of independence of Ukraine from the former Soviet Union, which, of course, at that point had collapsed. And actually, Ukraine's declaration of independence was a kind of final nail in the coffin of the old Soviet Union, the old USSR. And then you went through every 10 years, roughly, another phase of breaking free of the old Russian imperial grip. So the next moment was 2003, 2004, with the Orange Revolution led by Viktor Yushchenko. And I spent a morning with him recently. He's just a remarkable guy. He's the kind of Lech Walesa or Nelson Mandela equivalent in Ukraine. Very brave, of course, poisoned by persons unknown, but one can have a pretty good idea about who that was, with an agricultural toxin, and he basically his skin fell off his body. And some of you listeners who are old enough will remember those images of his face literally sort of falling off his body. Enormously brave, he and Yulia Tymoshenko. And then that sort of broke the Russian grip at one phase. And then you had 2014 when Yanukovych had come in, who's essentially the Kremlin's man in Kiev, and been challenged over his position on Europe, where the majority of people wanted to turn towards the West, and he wanted to turn closer towards Russia, which was essentially his paymaster. And that resulted in the Revolution of Dignity, in which more than 100 protesters were killed, shot dead by snipers in Maidan Square, the same place where the Orange Revolution had largely centered. And so 10 years more or less had passed, and that led to the presidency of Poroshenko. And then you had, and that immediately following that, of course, you had the Russian seizure of Crimea and the Donbass, virtually as a sort of penance for what had happened. And then from that, you then had the victory of Zelensky in 2019, and immediately following that, really almost this deterioration in relationships, as Zelensky did what the majority of his people wanted, which was to turn towards Europe. And because of that, the Russians, fearing their empire didn't really exist, and particularly for Putin as an ex-KGB man, He wanted to piece together this imperial notion, and the Russian Empire is not an empire without Ukraine. That Putin wanted to put this together, starting with the first building block, which is to bring Ukraine back within the fold and have somebody in situ who would do his bidding. And that wasn't going to be Zelensky, hence the kind of Russian narrative, which is remarkably successful since it's really based on three sort of fundamental lies, which are that Ukraine is not a country, which it certainly is, that it's that the war was all NATO's fault, which is absolutely not the case. I mean, NATO accepts members on application, doesn't go out looking for members. And the thirdly, it's run by neo-Nazis. And the fact that Zelensky is Jewish, of course, doesn't fit that narrative. And regardless, that's where the Russians were going with this, and they pushed very hard. But just to put this into some sort of, you know, personal context, because stories are always about people. They're not really about events. They're about what people are and what they do. Yesterday, I was at interviewing one of the directors of a company called Firepoint, which is responsible for manufacturing these long-range, most of these long-range drones that go into Russia. Just a remarkable story. Three people got together, one of whom had studied physics in Moscow, did a PhD in physics, one of whom was a film producer, and the other one was a concrete specialist. But she was born in 1994, I think it was, 1994. She was certainly born after 1991. And so that places it in context. These are what we would call in South African terms born frees, people who've experienced their life outside of the Soviet Union. And they got together and they built this company from scratch, starting in 2022 with a very simple drone, having bought a very expensive one and realized that was no way to go as a sort of volunteer organization. And now they produce 300 drones a day. So, I mean, it just is off the charts in terms of the production cycle. They're getting into all sorts of high-tech areas. And you spoke about the cycle of innovation. It's about... the cycle of news innovation here is about every 2 weeks. If you speak to the news agencies that are run by government as to how they counter Russian narratives, they're changing direction and methodologies every 2 weeks and the types of content. But every week, if you're in a big drone company or counter-drone company, the ones that knock down the Shahids, for instance, they send people into the field every week, and they're coming back with mostly right. software alterations, very few hardware alterations. They're more difficult to do. But given that the Russians are also themselves dynamic and they're coming up with changes and electronic warfare systems all the time, they're continuously innovating. And the cycle of innovation, as I say, as you term it, is probably every couple of weeks, something new is out there in the market. And it's very hard to keep up as a consequence. I try and sort of map out for myself in writing a book of the sort, the kind of drones on the marketplace. It's virtually a kind of losing game because every day there's something new appearing in the media. And that is yes. driven by an ecosystem in Ukraine, which is on the one hand political, as I've described. So there's this strong desire not to be told what to do. On the other hand, it's driven by the nature of the organization of Ukrainian society, which is very different to Russia. It's not hierarchical. It's horizontal. It's a bit like having, if I could seek a South African analogy, it's like having, you know, it's like a farmers cooperative. Everyone's working together and they're making a plan in that sort of very good South African way. And they're working with people. They're not relying on the state to do anything for themselves. They're working often around the state. But it's also because the state has now understood this and has got in behind them. So it's created a seed funding mechanism called Brave One for people doing things like drones or other high-tech bits of software, people converting vape, whatever they call them, puffers, into rechargeable battery stores. I mean, it's the technology is just literally off the charts. But people with wacky ideas, I say, operating horizontally in this regard. And then you've got this part of this really key part of the ecosystem is politics, there's seed funding, but then you've got people. And this is a country which has 130,000 to 140,000 science graduates every year, 4,000 to 5,000 PhDs every year. And it's churning out very bright, highly motivated people intent on making a plan. And then on top of all of this, you've got this incredible westward shift. And when I first came to Ukraine, you know, it was a kind of clunky version of a very poor Poland, not very well integrated, you know, had this sort of whiff of corruption everywhere. Now it's super digitized, much more dynamic. The business environment is cleaned up its act. People talk about corruption. I mean, of course, there's corruption, but people talk about it all the time. And there's much more of a sort of a sense of responsibility about that. But just think of this as one great integrator. You've now got 6 million Ukrainians living in Western Europe, and they're starting businesses, they're working, their kids are going to university. I know some of the people whose kids are at very good universities, very bright, highly motivated people, and that's a whole different network that has been created. So you've got this horizontal network now within Ukraine, which is doing stuff, whatever the state does, and then you've got this horizontal network now extending well into Western Europe outside of government. And that's where the funding has come from. A lot of the military units are funded by private donations, which of course makes them politically quite difficult to control. And there's going to be an aftermath and a reckoning in this regard. But when half their capital budget, for instance, on drones, comes directly to the units, and they can choose it based on their success rates in the use of, let's say, counter drones, they get credits for that, so-called e-coupons, and then they order their equipment directly. It creates a kind of much more of a market system which bypasses the central procurement mechanism. So
yes,
it's not just a revolution in military affairs. It's actually a revolution in government. It's a revolution in funding. And it's another phase in those every roughly 10-year phases that Ukraine has undergone since 1991.
So, you know, I think there's been a lot going on recently, actually, in Ukraine, of this sort of vision, this battle between two visions for the country. There's this is perhaps an unfair characterization, but I have made people make this characterization that you've got people who are sort of this old guard in the country who want to keep it more centralized. They have a more sort of often described as a Soviet mindset, and the sort of chief figure who was put up of this was the recently removed head of the Ukrainian armed forces, Oleksandr Sirsky, who was accused of basically being stuck in the old ways and sort of Soviet style thinking and wanting to centralize power and micromanaging from the top, as opposed to this more sort of dynamic market focused decentralized thing, which you know, has the point, I suppose, is that it doesn't have any one champion, but one of the people who was recently associated with this was Mikhail Fedorov, who was the Minister of Defense, who Zelensky recently removed, which sparked protests in Ukraine because people saw it as symbolic for this exact issue. They saw that there was this belief that Zelensky was choosing essentially the old ways of doing things by backing Sirsky over Fedorov because they had clashed in government. And I think that sort of horizontal versus vertical thing is playing out kind of across the whole of society. I thought that was by far the most interesting observation in your piece that you wrote for the Daily Friend. Now, you also mentioned the drone, the sort of fundraising of units. I remember these sort of popping up in early 2020 with, you know, often you'd have a military unit recording a video where they would say, we would like, you know, the public to give us money for this specific thing. And it was everything from bulletproof vests to artillery shells to drones to cars, which were often being used. And it's, I think, what people haven't necessarily fully grasped, and I think this is true of any technology, is that if you think about digital technology, right, it's actually relatively new. When I was born in 1993, the digital stuff was around, but I don't think society had fully understood what the power of this technology was. And every year that passes, we begin to kind of realize that there's yet another frontier that this technology can take us to. And what digital, in my mind, really does is it allows an opportunity for this absolutely incredible decentralization across sort of everything, as you've pointed out. And maybe it took a society under extreme stress, like Ukraine is, to see the sort of true potentials of all that. So just your thoughts on any of that.
Yeah, well, there's about a million questions in there. I mean, the Fedorov-Sersky thing is become a metaphor for the old versus the new. Fedorov, this 35-year-old former minister of digital transformation, versus a 61-year-old Soviet-trained artilleryman. And it's become a rather crude metaphor because Sersky is undoubtedly, an extremely competent general. Some would even say he's a military genius for having engineered the pushback in 2022, which basically relieved all the pressure on Sumy and Kharkiv. But a lot of people are critical of him for the bloodletting that happened in places like Andriivka and famously or infamously Bakhmut, where about 10,000 Ukrainians are said to have died, probably 100,000 Russian casualties, of which probably 30,000 deaths. But nonetheless, when you've got a larger population base, this maths of war matters. So the maths of war matters in a different way to Fedorov. Fedorov has constantly come out and said, we face this demographic disadvantage. We have 40 million people, basically, he doesn't say this, but I'm saying what this maths is. 40 million people, of whom 6 million live abroad, that's 34 million. Call me a liar, it's 35 million, just for round it out. And you've got about 12 million pensioners in that. So you're down to the sort of low 20s. Then you've placed a moratorium on people originally below 27, now below 25, not being called up because Zelensky wanted essentially not to sort of, obliterate the youth. This was a war for the youth, not by the youth of Ukraine. It was for their future, and so you didn't want them to be called up. And now you're seeing more pressure on that current demographic of above 25 years old, hence all the scenes for enforced mobilization and what we would call press ganging, which is a word that seemed to have gone out of fashion, but now sort of coming back in fashion because of this. So Fedorov would say, well, we face this demographic disadvantage. So and we really value our people, unlike the Russians, and we want to look after them, which is true. So we're going to use machines as a substitute, and I think that's a crude metaphor. I think there were other things at play there. There was the nature of funding, it's how the institutions were going to be funded. It was about the nature of procurement and cutting out some of the old largesse that existed in the system, and there was particular controversy about the cost of artillery shells, which are said to be about 20% more than they should have been because of the centralized nature of procurement of artillery. And just interestingly, the maths of war operates differently. Artillery shell cost around about $4,000 to $5,000 for a 155 millimeter artillery shell. FPV drone costs you about $300 to $350 now. And delivers essentially the same effect. So, the maths of war has been flipped. It always used to be the maths of war where demography was this determinant of Soviet power, and this now instance Russian power, and this overwhelming force of numbers. And now, of course, it's about a different number, which is the cost in terms of manpower, the cost in terms of the willingness of society to accept this, and of course financially. and Russia's feeling the squeeze of that cost, because when you've lost the best part of 12,000 tanks and armored vehicles, these things come with a cost attached to them, and they have to be replaced. And when you've lost 500,000 dead and 1.5 million wounded, or 1.5 million casualties, 1 million wounded, say 500,000 dead, and you've got to pay compensation to the families in Russia, or you've got to look after the wounded, which in some ways is even greater cost, then these things start having a financial element attached to them, and you've got you're running a special military operation. You're not running a full-scale invasion where you can demand mobilization and sacrifice. So the Russians have painted themselves into something of a political corner because of the economics of it all. But the interesting question in all of this is there something else at play with the Fedorov-Sirsky issue? Because if I remember correctly, Fedorov is the last minister in the Council of Ministers who was appointed in 2019, still to be there. So essentially, you've got a whole new bunch of ministers if you go back to the start of Zelensky's term, except for Zelensky. So now there's questions arising here, which is, you know, when is the election going to take place? If you're seeing this reset of ministers at this pace, at which point do we say that martial law is going to be dropped and we have elections, and then who will stand? And many would say that the Fedorov Zelensky Sirsky issue is a proxy for a political maneuver by one or other of the parties with an eye to that election. And particularly looming in the background in all of this is Valery Zhuhulzhny, the former chief of the armed forces, the commander in chief, Sirsky's predecessor, who fell out of favor with Zelensky, or they fell out over the counteroffensive, and Zhuhulzhny was then posted to London as ambassador. And he has made no secret of his political ambition. So, you know, like all these things, you know, they're extremely dynamic and extremely interesting, because, you know, Zelensky is the face of Ukraine, is a Churchillian type leader. But politically at home, he's having to improvise all the time to try and sort of stamp out the fires around himself, both domestically and within his own political circles. On the evolution militarily, I mean, I think the big question, if you want to extend the sort of Fedorov-Sirsky analogy, is where does the technology go in this direction of travel? Does it go towards increasing autonomous targeting? And that's already happening, because a lot of these systems work on, because of jamming, they work on essentially, for the benefits of your listeners and viewers, it's essentially a sort of photographic memory, which is then downloaded into the drone's memory or the missile's memory. And once it gets close to its target and gets jammed, the last mile or whatever the distance is, targeting is done by memory of the device itself. So you've programmed it to hit a bridge. The bridge looks like this, and it goes off and it searches for a bridge that looks like this. Now, of course, a lot of people with fearful would say, well, if you stop programming, it looks like this person, or it looks like this house, you start taking the human out of the loop. So most of these systems have a human loop factor and in the autonomous system. But of course, you're getting now into drone swarming, and you're getting into autonomous swarming as well. And at which point the human intervenes in that loop, I think is extremely it's extremely important. But there's a conscious element of making a decision, which many people in the West would see as absolutely necessary. The Russians, of course, don't have such quibbles when you're firing missiles willy-nilly into cities. You don't really care where they end up. The point is terror. The point is to erode the fighting will of the Ukrainians. But, strategic bombing generally, and Ukraine is no exception in this regard, stiffens people's political will because you become more than extremely annoyed about the person knocking out your heating or killing your neighbor if they haven't had a shot at you as well. So it's backfired very badly on the Russians, but it doesn't seem to stop them from basically firing off whatever. And I don't think AI would be a particular human rights concern of theirs either. So that's where that's going. The other big development in this war has been UGVs. And I've spent a bit of time with UGV manufacturers, and the world of military acronyms is never ending. That's unmanned ground vehicles. And so they take in logistics in that last mile and take out, well, last 5 kilometers, and take out wounded or whatever they need to do, take in food, water, ammunition, whatever people need. Because the conditions literally are that nothing that moves there survives. I mean, tanks are knocked out before they get to the kill zone. They're knocked out on the trains which are delivering them. So, it's a sort of no-go area. So they use UGVs because a UGV is it doesn't have a life attached to it. It can be repaired if it's destroyed, it's destroyed. And there's extremely novel UGVs now appearing. UGVs which swarm, UGVs which are used in attack mode, UGVs which can deliver other UGVs, UGVs which can deliver drones. So, the human out of the loop and using machines and digitization as a massive force multiplier. But that demands, and last point, command and control. Because and you as people say, what are the Ukrainians like? Well, this is a kind of bunch of anarchic hackers, basically. As a society which has had a heavy hand of sort of Soviet officialdom pressing down on it for years and years and years, they became very resistant because it was Russian centric and led. So they became very resistant to this authority on the one hand, and they made a plan on the other, as I mentioned earlier. But they also had this kind of burning spirit of resisting in their own kind of semi-anarchic kind of way. And that, the image of the Ukrainian hacker is a pretty good one for the way in which the command and control guys operate. And it's a war of techies in many senses. I've been to some of these places where they're operating. And these are guys with heavy metal tattoos and piercings and gear on them, beards not unlike yours, Nicholas, who look like out of a sort of a heavy metal Iron Maiden concert. They would be pretty well at home there. But they're operating and managing a three-dimensional battle space. With a software to boot and feeding in intelligence from multiple sensory overlays. So, one bit of intelligence would be to see a vehicle somewhere. Another bit of intelligence is to know what's in that vehicle and try and denote some sort of attention in intention to it. And they're able to layer on intelligence in very sophisticated ways from heat, from different senses, from social integrating with social media channels to create a full battlefield picture. So it's not just about autonomous drones flying around looking for targets. It's about who's operating this, how they're managing it, and how they've been able to discern pattern of activity and behavior by using their own technology. And I mean, one of the most extraordinary things I saw, which was I went out to don't tell my wife, but now she's going to know. I went out very close to the gray zone to a counter-drone unit in the sort of Kharkiv region. And the SkyMap, which is a software, runs off multiple thousands of acoustic sensors. So essentially it's a radar driven by acoustic sensory information, and you get a tracking of drones based on these readouts. So I mean, that's just one novelty which has come out of this war. And I think the thing that the West has suddenly cottoned on to, particularly since the Americans and Israelis embarked on their war in Iran, is they've suddenly realized how far ahead the Ukrainians are with relatively little. And they've done all this on the cheap. A lot of it's done with 3D printers. A lot of it's done. And I mean, I went to one counter-drone firm. They had a bank of 250 3D printers working 24/7. I've never seen anything quite like it. And the heat in the room was just to believe. But, you know, that, and that's a smaller facility that's out there. So, there are developments in this war which the West is going to have to take a long, hard look at itself. And I think it's overstating it to say that the West is behind. I think Western technology, I don't think the innovation cycle has been very clever in terms of new technology. What it's been is the ability of the Ukrainians to take off-the-shelf technology and to integrate it in very clever ways, which is always the mark of genius. You know, you make difficult things simple. And they then have translated that into very, very quick manufacturing processes. And they don't worry about, you know, there's not a lot of concern about, you know, getting the nth thing right, letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. They're interested in the good. And the good for Ukraine is territorial integrity and sovereignty and the right to determine their future.
So we will put a link, of course, to the piece you wrote for the Daily Friend down in the description. But I believe you just sent us another piece, actually, also that you've written there in Ukraine. So I encourage our listeners and viewers to look out for that on thedailyfriend.co.za. But anyway, Dr. Greg Mills, thank you so much for your time today. Absolutely fascinating stuff. And I think there are interesting sort of ideas we can take from this in the more abstract about how South Africans, we have a state not very effective. And so I think this perhaps should inspire South Africans about what you can do when you just sort of get on with it and make a plan yourself. It gives you great ability to achieve things.
I think the message from Ukraine is very simply, you know, give people a chance and they'll sort it out.
Yes, exactly. And with that, thank you very much. And we hope you all had a wonderful day. We'll see you soon on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers.